It's the morning show. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kate Archer Kent. Today in On Your Money, we look at the scandal facing Facebook and ask if it's time for you to unfriend the social media giant. We'll be starting with that subject this morning, but we'll also be talking about when to hire an actual human being to do your taxes. We'll be talking about a bonus to saving for retirement, and we'll be talking about why remodeling your home maybe better than moving. And we welcome once again our guest this morning, Kevin McKinley, a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin, good to have you with us again.
Hello,
Glenn.
Glenn?
Yes.
Is it Glenn? Hi, Glenn.
And we'd like you, as always, dear listeners, to chime in with your personal financial question for Kevin McKinley. If you've got something you'd like answered, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org. That's onyourmoney@wpr.org. Or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, for many of us, Facebook has become an important and influential source of information and connections. But recent events have some users wondering how much they actually like Facebook.
Yeah, Glenn, the origin of Facebook, it was originally called FaceMash. And as legend has it, and if you've seen the movie, it was created in a Harvard dorm 14 years ago this February. But like a lot of 14-year-olds, it's creating some problems for the rest of us, and we're a little angry with it. Facebook currently has 2 billion users, 8 joining every second, and more than two-thirds of American adults are on Facebook. The company's valuation, it's a publicly traded stock, the company's valuation was about $530 billion just a few months ago, more than $500 billion worth. But it's declined drastically. About $100 billion has disappeared because users are allegedly upset with the company for sharing information. And it came to light with Cambridge Analytica that is being charged with getting the information on 50 million Facebook users and using it improperly for political purposes. And the issue really comes down to people just figuring out that if you are getting a free service, you are actually the product. The information that you are putting on Facebook is being used by Facebook and other companies to for commercial uses, for political uses. Plus, there's other threats about it that have been more prevalent and really are more dangerous, I think, than just the information being shared.
Now, how much of this is kind of a change in the Facebook business model? When it started out, it was kind of a way for college kids to share embarrassing pictures with one another. I remember when I first got involved in Facebook, my daughter was quite horrified that
you ruined it, didn't you?
So it's changed quite a bit. It's now gone mainstream. I guess there are growing pains. Is this some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the other issues that they have out there are, you know, whenever you put information on there, it's always going to be available to strangers who can see, you know, when you're traveling, they can see things that you own, and they can take advantage of you being out of the house and to go in and get that stuff for themselves. Employers are also looking at your Facebook accounts to get a better idea of what kind of person they're actually hiring. CareerBuilder says that 70% of employers admit to viewing applicants' social media accounts, and 50% of employers view current employees' social media accounts. And again, Facebook is going to be the most ubiquitous one of all those employees. So there's a good chance your boss has taken a look at your Facebook page and seen the information on there. It can also damage relationships. The Pew Foundation did a survey, and they said that 18% of respondents say that their online relationships have been damaged by interacting with people on Facebook. And I'm sure that was especially true in the last 18 months or so after the last election. And people can be hurt by what's on Facebook just by looking at other people's information. A third of respondents said they feel worse after logging on to Facebook and viewing their so-called friends' lives than they did before they logged on.
Well, comment if you could on the scandal involving this bundling of information and giving it to folks that we may not want to have it, and what kind of threats that can pose to you.
Yeah, a lot of people like the platform. 67% from that Pew Foundation says it actually helps online relationships, helps us keep better connected, get to see pictures of the grandkids, find out what's going on in people's lives pretty easily. And Facebook actually, as online information sharing companies go, Facebook actually has been one of the better ones out there. Right now, you've got the company scrambling. The Federal Trade Commission is going to be investigating. Congress is breathing down their necks. And 24 attorneys general are also saying, hey, Facebook, we got to see, what are you doing to protect all this information that you have for people? And the information is really, that's the biggest issue. It's not so much what Facebook itself is doing. It's that they aren't protecting the information when they send it off to other users. And when you use apps within Facebook that, quite frankly, Facebook doesn't have as much control over how that information is used. And that's part of the problem. So one thing you can do is you can start by logging out of Facebook whenever you're not using it. Because if you're logged into Facebook, it's a lot easier for the service to track where you're going and what other people are seeing about your activity. Don't like things if you can help it. That also adds to the information that they can put together. Get into your privacy settings there and really start closing those down to the point where only the people you really want to see information can actually see information. And then finally, if you have some people in there who just really, you know, you don't know them very well or you don't really have a connection, you may want to unfriend them. And if they make us think about it, just say it's because of the privacy issues. I'm trying to limit the network of people I share information with. And this was part of this. It's no offense. And then finally, when you do use third-party apps within Facebook, make sure that you know how they're using your information above and beyond what Facebook does. And if you don't like it, don't use the app.
I've got more than 1,000 friends on Facebook. And
now you're bragging, Glenn.
Well, yeah, but I guess I am. But you know, there are a lot of people who have thousands of friends on Facebook. It sounds like you're saying that's not a good idea.
Well, it's not so much that it's not a good idea. It's just that the more friends you have, the more potential openings you have for your information to be passed along in ways that you just wouldn't do. And obviously, it feels good to have all those so-called friends on there, although a lot of them are probably people you sat next to in history class 40 years ago and haven't really talked to since. I don't know if...
Or people you don't even know that might have liked something that you posted at some time, you know, in your past. And I'm sure a lot of people do that.
Exactly. And you know, some people are just deciding, there's even a Twitter meme about this, that you're just deciding, you know what, I'm going to delete my Facebook account. And the process to do so is actually readily available at Facebook. If you log onto your Facebook page, you can see how to go about that. Now, as part of that, you may actually want to download your file of all of the posts and pictures and everything like that that you have saved and liked in your Facebook account so that you have it for your future use, and you can do it in an electronic file. And interestingly enough, when you go and download that file, you'll find that there's a lot of stuff on there that you didn't know about. So attempting to download the file is a good way to figure out what Facebook and other services might know about you, and that may motivate you more to say, gee, if they know all this stuff about me, I'm really uncomfortable using it for it. Let friends know that you're thinking about doing this, though, in advance, ironically enough, by posting it on your Facebook page.
Right.
And then you might want to return to just communicating with people via email and text, keeping it a little private, and you may see a return to blogs where people control the content a little better, control the users and who saw their information. And that wouldn't surprise me for people who like posting on Facebook to just go back to putting a blog page up and then being able to share information that way.
Realistically, how do you really think this is going to happen? Facebook is so ubiquitous, so many people use it.
Well, yeah, a lot of people use it. A lot of younger people don't use it. And I don't think it's likely that they will jump on it 15 or 20 years from now. They're more likely to be, you know, I have teenagers and they'd laugh at me if I said, you know, what's your Facebook page? Because they think it's for old people like us. And they're right, quite frankly. The age of the user is going up and older people tend to like Facebook more than younger people. Younger people are more likely to use Snapchat, WhatsApp, and some other communication devices. So I don't think that I don't think it's going to be something that goes away at all, but I just do think it's going to be something that the next big thing will take a lot of their share sooner or later.
Well, it's interesting that Facebook, which started out as being a service primarily for young people, is now primarily a service for old people.
That's right.
You know, Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC. That's a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And if you would like to ask Kevin a question about financial matters, the phone number again is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email him at onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll come back with some of your phone calls and financial questions for Kevin McKinley. It's On Your Money. I'm Glenn Mobrigan for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobrigan for Kate Archer Kent. It's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. If you've got a personal financial question, you can ask him at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Christy emails, and I can't quite read it. It's just slipped out of my, there we go. I am 57 years old and have paid off about one half of my student loans. I finished school during a very difficult time, including going through a bankruptcy over 7 years ago and losing my home that was all about 8 years ago. Christy graduated with a nursing degree and pays about $350 a month in student loans. She wants to know if she should continue to pay the loans monthly or take a big hit on savings and pay them off in one lump sum. The highest interest rate on her loans is 6.8%. Kevin?
Yeah, Christy, first of all, you related the bad news, but there's good news in your story. The first one is that, you know, this bankruptcy that you've gone through, usually after people go through bankruptcy, after about 10 years, it goes off the credit report. And so that will stop affecting your credit within about 3 years. And sadly, those 3 years are going to come faster than any of us want them to. So be patient and stick with your current plan. And the bankruptcy will eventually go away. Your credit will get better. And today, I would definitely say do not pay those student loans off. Yes, it really stinks to pay interest charges on it, but when you take all of your savings and use it to pay debt off, you save a little bit of money in interest, but you lose the liquidity. And it sounds like you've already been through something which millions of Americans have gone through, that you ran out of money before the month. And when you do that, you have a hard time paying the bills, and it starts piling up because you get interest charges plus late fees, et cetera. Your credit score goes down, which then boosts up the interest cost even more so. And then once you get into the snowball, then that's when the bankruptcy happens again. So please just make the bare minimum payment that you have to keep current on those loans, Christy. And 6.8% is not a great interest rate for borrowing money, but it's still pretty good. And so go real slow, pay those off real slowly. And I hope you just have so much extra money that you don't know what to do with it by the time those are paid off. But good for you. You got your education got you a good job, and hopefully you can use that higher income to eventually get back on your feet. And it sounds like so far that's exactly what you're doing. So congratulations.
Thank you, Christy. Let's go to David in Slinger. David, you're on Your Money with Kevin McKinley.
Yes, my question is about Roth conversions. I'm 67. I work very part-time. How much can I convert? I know that whatever I take out, I want to avoid going to the next highest tax bracket. But I guess I'm confused about how much I can do.
Yeah, David, you can actually convert all of your IRA to a Roth IRA. And for people who aren't familiar with this, what this does is you basically take all the money out of your IRA. Whatever you take out is added to whatever other taxable income you have, so it can be taxed. And then you put it into a Roth IRA. And the Roth IRA has several advantages over the IRA. One is that there's no taxation on withdrawals. When you pull the money out of the Roth IRA, you won't pay taxes on it. The distributions, as of today anyway, do not make your Social Security taxable from the Roth IRA, nor are there any required minimum distributions. So you can leave the money in the Roth IRA as long as you want until you pass away and pass it on. And then generally the inheritors usually have to pull the money out, but only at their life expectancy. And as they do it, it's still tax-free. The danger, though, David, is that you may be taxed at a higher rate, as you mentioned, if you pull it all out all at once. Are you collecting Social Security right now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and that's another thing. Social Security is technically tax-free, but there's a formula that the IRS uses to determine, it's kind of a means testing for the taxation of Social Security. And what they basically do is they take all of your other income and half of your Social Security, and they add it together into a formula. And if that formula exceeds certain thresholds that were set back in 1983 and not adjusted upwards for inflation at any time over the last 35 years and aren't going to be anytime soon, so they're more likely to snare more and more people, then that can make your Social Security taxable. So it's kind of a double whammy. When you make the conversion, not only do you have to pay taxes on the earnings, but then it can also make your Social Security taxable. So be very cautious about converting large dollar amounts. And what you want to do, David, is go to a place like TurboTax or H&R Block.com, and they usually have online tax calculators that you can use even for the 2018 tax year, which is where we're at right now, that you can use to say, well, if I put in, if here's the rest of my numbers for income, part-time income, interest, Social Security, whatever, and then I'm going to start playing with some dollar amounts for converting. And if I convert $5,000 of an IRA to a Roth IRA, what will the actual tax bill be? And you can do that to get kind of a sense of where you should be. Are you a single filer or married filing jointly, David?
Joint.
Okay. You can probably convert about enough to get you to about $100,000 of gross income before you get into the 22% federal income tax bracket. Right now for 2018, anything under that amount would be in the 12% federal income tax bracket. But again, it can grab your Social Security, make it taxable too. So be very careful about over converting.
All right, David, thank you so much for the phone call. You're listening to On Your Money with Kevin McKinley on The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent, 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a financial question for Kevin McKinley, or you can email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. One of our listeners, Karen, says, my husband uses one of the online tax prep programs to do our taxes each year. I would prefer that we have a tax specialist do them. What are your thoughts?
Well, actually, many people agree with you, Karen. Over 50%, just barely over 50% of taxpayers actually use a human being. And they do it because, you know, taxes can be complex to a lot of people, and they're afraid of making a mistake that's going to invite the ire of the revenue departments of their state or the federal government. And sometimes they use it for just one time, or they do it every single year no matter what. Some people are under the perception if they bring their taxes to a tax person that they're going to, that the tax preparer is going to find hundreds or thousands of dollars or tax savings that they otherwise would miss. And that could be the case, but many of these online solutions are pretty intuitive in asking you about your situation and finding areas that you might be able to save some money in taxes. So I would do it, but I would do it more so for the comfort, if you're thinking about doing this, of just shoving it over to someone else and then having them be responsible for it, and then it's off your plate.
That human being, of course, is more expensive than using an online service. What can people expect to pay?
Yeah, they're probably, you know, an online service can be anywhere from free under the free file program up to maybe to $150 for the more sophisticated online programs. But you're probably going to pay anywhere from a couple hundred to a couple thousand dollars for a tax preparer or a CPA. It's usually about $500 to $1,000 for most people, and it's less for non-CPAs, unless if you're just a, you know, if you don't own a business or you don't have a very complex financial situation, $300 to $500 is probably what you can expect to spend.
And if you do have a business and you've got complicated taxes, would you recommend people go to an actual human being to have
absolutely
those taxes done?
Absolutely. I'm a much bigger fan of that for business owners, because there are so many different ways that you can really manipulate your income and the money that you spend on the business that can help you in a given year versus next year. Again, tax preparers, the ones I've dealt with, have really been great, but they're not
predisposed to be great at planning for future years. It's just something I found that I've done this for 30 years and I've run into a lot of them. And it just genetically, I don't think CPAs are comfortable making projections out and saying, well, you should do this for next year and this for the year after. So some of that you're going to have to shoulder yourself as a business owner, but it still helps to have an expert at your side telling you what your decisions, the ramifications of your decisions might be, because there's so many different places to screw up, and having that extra person there can really help save you some money and a lot of trouble.
Well, we're less than 3 weeks away from tax day now, so what are your thoughts about Karen and her husband getting a preparer for their taxes? What should they be doing right now?
I like the idea for 2018's taxes. You know, like you said, Glenn, we're 3 weeks away. It's going to be tough to find a person, get an appointment, and find someone you're comfortable with. So if you can, do the online TurboTax, whatever you do right now. A compromise might be to use H&R Block system, because H&R Block is not the favorite online system out there. TurboTax usually gets better reviews, but H&R Block has more of a human element to it. You can obviously go see someone in your local office if you have one nearby, or they also have individuals who will be able to help you as well over the phone or with chat things, and some of the other online services don't have as much of a human presence. But once you get this year's taxes done for 2017, then start looking for a new preparer in May. That'll give you more time to meet different candidates and discuss your situation and find one you like, and especially with the big changes in the tax laws for 2018. And a qualified tax preparer will not only help you with 2018's taxes, but should look at your previous year's filings as well and see if everything you did was appropriate and if you got all the savings that you possibly were entitled to. And if you like using that person, great, continue it. But not if not, you'll know what you're going through, and you'll understand the experience, and you can go back to the online solution for your 2019 taxes.
It's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a personal finance question, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Ellie, who is on the road to Eau Claire. Ellie, you are on Your Money with Kevin McKinley.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a question about QuickBooks and online bookkeeping software. I'm just starting an e-commerce business. I just incorporated as an LLC, and obviously I need a lot of help with my finance. So do you have any idea what I should be doing?
Yeah, QuickBooks is actually, you know, it's part of the Intuit family, but they're all kind of linked to each other because they've all kind of been swallowed up now by the larger service. But yeah, I've been a small business owner for 30 years, and I really think that QuickBooks is the best way to start out, again, because they do a great job of not only helping you file your taxes, but also making sure if you need quarterly estimates, they help you with that. If you're figuring out different sales tax issues, they can help you with that. And then again, get this for your 2017 taxes if you started the business before January 1st of this year. And then after you kind of get this 2017 year done, you definitely want to think about trying to find an individual who can hopefully not only help you prepare your taxes and make sure that your quarterly estimates and everything are getting filed if you need to do that, payroll taxes if that's a necessity, self-employed taxes, but then also someone who can help you plan out and make the best of your situation.
And once again, 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to talk to Kevin McKinley, On Your Money at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin McKinley, On Your Money. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We all know it's a good idea to save for our retirements, but the IRS gives us a little-known incentive to do so.
Yeah, Glenn, it's called the Savers Credit, and it's available to people who are 18 and older, who are not full-time students, and not a dependent of any other tax filer out there. And they give you money anytime you make a contribution to a qualified retirement plan. And these are all kinds of retirement plans, certainly IRAs and Roth IRAs, but your at-work plan, your 401ks, 403b, even 457 plans, all qualify for the Savers Credit. And you can get information on to figure out if you qualify by going to irs.gov and downloading Form 8880. That's 8880 at irs.gov, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com later on today.
How much is available to those who qualify?
It depends on your income and your filing status. The credit amount is anywhere from 10 to 50% of the amount that you actually contributed out of your own pocket to the retirement plan. And then the income limitations are anywhere from $0 to $63,000 of adjusted gross income. That's line 4 if you file the 1040EZ, line 21 on the 1040A, and line 37 if you file the regular 1040.
Now give us an example of how the saver's credit would actually work.
Okay, so let's say you're a single filer and you've done your taxes and you figured out your adjusted gross income is $30,000. That puts you in the range of getting a 10% credit. And if you make a $5,000 contribution to any qualified retirement plan, you will get 10% of that back in the form of a tax credit. So your $5,000 will give you an instant 10% return of $500.
And what's the best way to take advantage of this?
Yeah, assuming you qualify, you've got the earned income for it, or you've got the spousal income for it. In my mind, the best way to do it is actually using the Roth IRA, because by definition, people who make these contributions have to be in a lower income bracket, and they have to have lower income, which is great. I like giving incentive to people who are struggling to still try to put aside whatever they possibly can for their own retirement. But because they're in a low-income tax bracket, the tax break they get from contributing to 401ks or IRAs isn't as valuable to them. And they probably can't afford to lock up that money for a long time. So if they use the Roth IRA, they don't get a tax break on it, but they still can qualify for the saver's credit. And the great thing about Roth IRAs, as both the regular listeners of On Your Money know, you can pull the contributions to a Roth IRA back out whenever you want, at any time, for any reason, with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. So if you have some money in a savings account, you're thinking about putting it aside, slide it over into the Roth IRA, qualify for the saver's credit, and then if you run into an emergency down the road, you can always pull that money back out at any time with no taxes or penalties and whatsoever. Again, it's only the earnings on that investment that may be penalized if you pull it out before 59 and a half and taxed.
You've got a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Katie in Eau Claire. Katie, you are on Your Money with Kevin McKinley.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello. So I just kind of panicked yesterday. I put my taxes together. My husband's a small business owner, and I itemized a bag full of receipts from him for the entire year, which I was not happy about.
Right.
And I realized, holy smokes, our money is going everywhere, but specifically, we are really struggling in the wintertime because of the type of work that he does.
Mm-hmm.
Any tips, any tricks that I can use to help us budget for the 7-8 months out of the year that we do well and the 4 months that we really struggle with?
Yeah, we're back to a post-industrialized economy right now, Katie, and we're moving, sadly, more towards a gig economy. More and more people are working in this manner than have done so for decades. And it means that, you know, the good news is you're self-employed. The bad news is you're self-employed. And it means that the income can be sporadic. It can be great for sometimes, but then poor during others. And that might be seasonal, as in your case, it might be just based on the amount of jobs you can do or the jobs that are available. Katie, have you and your husband ever sat down and said, "And this is what we spent in 2017, and here's where it all went"?
So I have.
All right. So 50% of you have done that, right?
Say it again. I'm sorry.
50% of you have done that, right? Of you and your husband.
50% of us have done it. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Yeah, and that's common in couples. There's a spender and there's a saver. There is a money person and a non-money person, and people often apologize for that dichotomy in the couple. It's actually natural, because hopefully in a couple you bring complementary skills and abilities to the relationship and make yourselves stronger as a couple than you would be if you were on your own or with the exact same kind of person. So that's great, but the bad news is it can lead to conflict. And so your husband really needs to bring himself and his money and his spending to the table. And one way you can do that is by signing up at something like Mint.com. And again, we're talking about privacy. This is a free service, but you have to give up your privacy of your spending and his spending. But they will track it for you and tell you where it's going. And so you can at least, you can do two things. First of all, you can figure out what is the base spending that you need to cover every single month, and then figure out what you can do in the good months to cut off spending so that you have something in the bad months and to cover that base amount for it. And the second thing that's nice about it is you and your husband can hopefully look at something that you're spending and say, you know what, we really don't need to spend $200 a month on eating out, or rather than going to the bar, can we get a bottle of wine or a six-pack of beer and drink it at home with our friends or ourselves, or like I do down in the basement next to the furnace? I think it's a really good time to do that, especially in light of the taxes. And I'm guessing your husband is the kind of person where he doesn't really enjoy paying taxes, correct?
Yes.
Okay, then this is a good time to say, hey, if we go through our spending, maybe we can figure out ways to not only cut back, make sure we go through these tough months okay, that we get through these months all right, but then also we can do some things with maybe within the business that help us save on taxes, because we're not just living hand to mouth all the time. We can do some planning in the good months and then make sure that our taxes are lower. And that's often, for many of us, that's the quickest way to increase the money that we have, is by cutting our taxes. Legally, we often can't go to our boss and say, just give me more money, but we can cut our taxes. And so that's a way to go through it. So that's the way I would approach it with him and say, can we just figure out where it went and figure out what we might be missing on deductions that we're spending that could be used for the business. And so let's figure out where those expenditures are going. Maybe they're deductible, and that alone might save us some money and help us get through these tougher months.
All right. Thank you so much, Katie. Let's go to Jerry now in River Falls. Jerry, you are on Your Money with Kevin McKinley.
Yeah, I just have a quick question about a bankruptcy. And the question is, I had a bankruptcy that was filed, discharged, and done back in end of 2008-2009, and it's still on my credit report. And yeah, I have not had any derogatory remarks since then.
Yeah, good for you. Was it a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, Jerry?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. And good for you. That's phenomenal. I mean, you should actually be extremely proud that you went through this really tough financial time, and now you've gone 9 years with, as you said, no derogatory marks on your credit report. Are you going to be applying for credit anytime soon, like trying to get a loan at all, or are you just concerned about it still being there? Okay, what are you going to be borrowing money for and when?
I want to be looking at possibly a mortgage within the next year or so.
Okay, for a new purchase or a refinance?
New purchase. I already have a mortgage and a home right now.
Great. Yeah, have you checked your credit score, Jerry? Do you know what it is? I'm sorry, say that again.
Well, I think we just lost Jerry.
Okay, good. Well, I hope it's not literally, just figuratively and only over the phone. But Jerry's a great story, and I have really good news for him. He only is going to have to wait one more year for that Chapter 7 bankruptcy filing to get off his credit report. And especially with no marks or anything like that, if he can just hold off for one more year, it's going to look much better. And he's going to do, and especially if he has a mortgage already that the new lender can go to, or his current lender can go to if he wants to get the mortgage from the same person. He maybe should talk with them right now and just sit down and say, hey, obviously that's on there, but it's been 9 years and that's pretty good. And you can see I've handled this responsibly. I'm going to be applying for a mortgage 12 months from now. What should I be doing in the next 12 months to make sure I get the best rate possible?
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. It is On Your Money, and it's the morning show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We'll be back with more of your questions after this short break. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show, and it's On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Kevin, many homeowners are looking for a new place, but it might be more cost-effective to make improvements on your current home.
Yeah, especially, Glenn, in this market, remodeling is generally much less expensive than relocating if you're already happy in your current neighborhood. You know, first of all, you might have to make improvements to your current place to make it more attractive to potential buyers. You might have to make improvements to the new place. They might even be aesthetic, but even things like, you know, putting in new floors or even just painting, removing wallpaper can be expensive. And then, you know, all the time you have to spend preparing the old place and looking for a new one. And the agent's listing commission as well. If you do go through a real estate agent, you can probably expect to spend 6% of the value of the home on that commission. So if you move to a $300,000 home, that's $18,000 alone that goes out the window. And once you add up all the time and money spent trying to sell your old house and move into a new one, you're going to end up spending and losing way more money than most home remodeling projects will cost you.
Plus, there aren't a lot of homes on the market right now.
There are not. It's extremely limited inventory in most markets. A lot of people are just staying put. They're happy with the house they have, and they're not moving on to another one. In the more desirable areas, we're seeing lots of bidding areas at valuations of really surprising, even to someone like me who I've had to deal with clients and their buying and selling of homes over the last three decades. I'm really surprised to see what some of these places are going for right now. It's good news for you if you do live in a hot area, but if you're going to be buying in a hot area, you're probably going to pay a lot more than you expect to. And even new construction is okay of new residential homes. It's not as good as it probably needs to be to absorb the demand, and you're more likely to have to move further out in the country if you're doing that. And more people, as we get older, actually want to move closer to the city and other amenities. So it's unlikely that a lot of people want to live far out in the country to get that new construction.
So you go out to the hardware store and you buy some hammers and nails and a paintbrush. Where do you go from there? Where do you start on improving your current home?
Well, for me personally, Glenn, I'm the least handy person I know, so I call the guy. That's where I start. But if you feel you've watched enough of these home improvement channels, think you can do it yourself and you're ready to go, first of all, know that all of those projects that they quote on those home improvement channels, take whatever figure they give you and then double it. And that's the more accurate figure of what it's actually going to cost you to redo a kitchen or bathroom. But if you're looking to know what needs to be done that gives you the best bang for the buck, we'd like to put this in three categories: low cost, medium, and big projects. For low cost, and that's maybe $5,000 or less, a new front door, new paint inside the house for today's colors, and new insulation throughout the house will give you the biggest return on investment in terms of both the money you put into it and then how it increases the value, and in the case of the insulation, how much you can hopefully save in the form of lower heating and cooling bills. For medium projects, somewhere in the $5,000 to $20,000 range, a new roof, new windows, and then new siding give you the highest return on investment according to Remodeling Magazine, and they ought to know. And also redoing the bathroom, going back in and putting new countertops, new fixtures in. That's going to be a little bit more expensive, but that's something that's relatively easy to do from a cost standpoint, and that's something that's going to have a big effect on the value of your home. And then finally, the big projects, $20,000 to $50,000. Redoing the kitchen is the number one, and that's where we spend most of our time of all the different rooms in the house. So redoing the kitchen is the best way to get a return on your investment. Adding a bedroom and a bathroom is a lot easier than trying to find a new house. It's a big project, depending on the situation that you're in for your house and the layout, but adding a bedroom and then finally finishing the basement, which for a lot of people, that can, they put a bedroom with an egress window and a bathroom down there, that can kind of kill two birds with one stone, because you're not only adding much more living space on it, but you don't have to add out and build out from the exterior of your house.
So how are you going to pay for it all?
Yeah, it's okay to borrow in this environment, and it's probably a good idea for most people to do that, because prices have risen in the last few years, and hopefully that's increased the amount of equity that you have in your home, and it allows you to tap that equity to use to further the improvements and maybe even boost up the equity even more. I would suggest most of these people get a home equity loan or a home equity line of credit. This is one more way that remodeling is less expensive than moving, because it's cheaper usually to get a home equity loan or a home equity line of credit from a lender than it is to go get a straight 15 or 30 year mortgage. But that said, even with interest rates going up a little bit recently and the higher expense, for some people, it may be a good time to finance lots of things through this new mortgage. And in a couple weeks, we're going to talk about if you should refinance for a new mortgage and then how you would use that money.
Well, Sean called from Pleasant Prairie but couldn't stay with us. He and his wife bought a house in an estate sale last year. It needs some updating, but it has what he calls good bones. But they're wondering why the value of the house fluctuates so much on the online services like Zillow or Trulia. Mm-hmm. They also want to know if they'd recoup the $10,000 they'd spend for a backyard fence when they ultimately sell the house.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, let's start. First question first. Those services are fun, like Trulia and Zillow, for estimating what your house is worth. But they're practically useless. I mean, there's a hierarchy of how homes should be valued. At the top is what someone with cash is willing to pay for it. The next best way to think of a home's valuation is what someone who has to get a mortgage is willing to pay for it. The third one is probably an appraiser, a qualified appraiser. The fourth one is a real estate agent. The fifth one is Trulia or Zillow, because they're just trying to guess and they have no idea. You know, they can't even see what's inside the house or anything like that. They're just going by square footage and they can't tell anything about it. They're just relating it to comps in the neighborhood and they make it fun to look at, but I wouldn't use it as a source of information. In terms of getting the money back on the fence, probably not. Fences tend to deteriorate pretty quickly unless you put a lot of money into one that has a composite material, and they can look pretty ratty after 5 to 10 years, but that's not a reason that you should avoid it. It just means that you shouldn't expect to get the money back in the form of a higher price for the house down the road.
I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show and On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. Let's go to Jim in River Falls. Jim, you are on Your Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having the program. So my question is, I'm 54, and I've got quite a bit in savings, probably somewhere around $1.2 million. I'm going to have a pension, which I don't want to take until I'm 66, so that I get the full amount. Otherwise, I'll get a smaller amount back. But I guess I've got my house paid for. I've got no mortgage or anything like that. And I'm considering retiring early. I guess the concern I have is with health insurance, and just wanting to get opinion on. If I would quit my job, I could continue with insurance there indefinitely, I guess. But for my wife is 52, and I've got a 12-year-old. I'd be paying about $1,800 or $1,850 a month. I do live in Wisconsin. I don't know, thoughts on where I should look for health insurance, and if it would be better for me to, try to do it through federal or state insurance programs.
You're in an enviable position for lots of reasons. One is that you can even think about retiring, and another one is you can think about it at a very, very young age. A couple things to go back with you. I would, especially if you do retire, I would strongly tell you to take your pension sooner rather than later. You know, when you say, yeah, we get a higher check at 65 than I would get at 54, well, that also reflects the fact that you're missing out on 11 years of checks that you would otherwise be able to receive. And it takes a long time of life past 65 of collecting those higher checks before you break even. It's usually about 80. And then the pension, is it a state pension or is it a private company pension?
So the pension, the pension is... So if I took my pension now, I'd be getting probably $1,600 to $1,700 a month. If I wait till I'm 65, it'd be closer to.
Okay, but is it from the state of Wisconsin or is it a private company?
It's a state pension.
Okay, yeah, they've already figured out how long someone like you is going to live. So for your situation, would you have to draw money from your savings to otherwise support yourself, or does your spouse work, or?
My spouse works part-time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be really hesitant to do this, in part because you're retiring at a very young age, and if you can stay on a little longer, you know, you've got 11 years until you qualify for Medicare, and that's assuming the Medicare eligibility age stays at 65. That is a long time and a lot of money to have to cover health insurance, and it's not just for you, it's for your spouse, too, and your child. And your spouse is 52, so she's going to have actually 13 years before she qualifies as well. And if you do decide to go, though, I would say I'd rather have you take the pension sooner rather than later. Keep your savings set aside so that you can not only cover uncovered health care costs, but you can preserve it to invest in the future if you need it, earn interest, etc. But that $1,800 is eye popping for a lot of people, but it's true. Even if you can qualify for insurance and other under ACA and Obamacare, it's easier now for people in your situation to get insurance. You know, for before ACA, Obamacare came into place, I'd have lots of people who would come to me, Jim, like you, and say, hey, we think we have enough money to retire. We're not 65 yet, but in 1987, I got a lump that was removed, and now it's very difficult for us to even afford health insurance, much less qualify for it. So what do we do? And I didn't have a good answer. The answer was just keep working until you reach Medicare eligibility. In your case, I'd say if you are going to do it, you probably want to start with your own company first, because it's probably hard to get back on that, and then have that cover you for a while and see if see what you think about the price. But yeah, you can expect to probably pay about $500 per person per month for health insurance and other out-of-pocket expenses. And in your case, you know, hopefully your 12-year-old's going to grow up and be prosperous, but for the time being, the kid might be on your insurance for another 10 to 15 years, and therefore that's going to be an extra cost out of your pocket as well. And even if you have enough money to retire, right now, you're talking about retiring at a time when stock prices and other asset prices are at or near all-time highs, and that's usually typically not a great time to retire if you're kind of on the edge. If you can retire with a lot less money, that's okay, but I'd say try to hold off a little longer if possible.
All right. Thank you so much, Jim. And let's squeeze in one more quick phone call from Christina in Glenwood. Christina, you're going to have to be fast with us. We're down to our last couple of minutes here.
Oh, wise one, I'm honored that you'll advise me. I'm wondering if I should, I have an equity note coming due, and I'm wondering if I should refinance my home to 30 years and roll this into it, or borrow more for home improvements. My home is about 30 years old. I'll need a furnace, front porch, appliances, et cetera.
Yep, Christina, you can tune in a couple weeks. We'll be addressing that topic. But otherwise, yes, I'd say get a new 30-year mortgage, get a fixed-rate mortgage, and get as much as the lender will allow without having to charge you private mortgage insurance. That's usually going to be 80% of the loan-to-value.
All right. Thank you so much, Christina. And Kevin McKinley, what is the website of the week?
We were talking, Glenn, about whether you should improve or move. Well, HomeGain.com actually has a calculator, and it's pretty detailed. You can enter all the information about how much it might cost to improve your home versus the cost of buying a new one. And it's really good at picking up a lot of details that most people don't think about until they actually run into them. HomeGain.com has an improve or move calculator. We'll put a link to that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com. Later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. This hour was produced by our executive producer, Michelle Johnson, with technical direction by Mike Dieringer. I'm Glenn Moberg, and for Kate Archer Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.